And Mr. Satinsky, is it okay if we also record the Zoom call? It's just insurance, basically.
Hey, Slavic Connection listeners, it's Nick and Misha. Today we had the great pleasure of talking to Daniel Satinsky about his most recent book, Creating the Post-Soviet Russian Market Economy Through American Eyes.
Mr. Satinsky is an attorney, business consultant, and independent scholar. He has been to Soviet Union and Russia multiple times. He has very rich base of experiences, so please take a listen.
It's not typical Texas.
You're listening to The Slavic Connection, brought to you by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies and the William P. Clinton Center for National Security at the University of Texas at Austin.
All right, well, welcome, Mr. Satinsky, to the Slavic Connection.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, and I just like to start off with kind of an easy but hard question. What were you thinking when you wrote this book? What did you what did you envision as maybe the purpose of writing about, you know, the 1990s, which, you know, for at least my generation, I was a baby, so I don't remember, but...
Sure. Sure. Well, first of all, it was an important part of my life. So a lot of this book tracks my own experiences and my own interest in Russia. And even in those days, it was difficult to get people to pay attention. You know, you'd come back from a trip and people would go, how was Russia? And any more than a sentence or two, their eyes would start to glaze over and you'd lose them. But there was a really important historical process going on, and most of us who were part of it recognized it as an important historical process. And it was a unique period in time. It was a time in which Russians and Americans mixed in numbers that had never before occurred. And certainly changed dramatically in our times as well. So there was this interchange of Americans and Russians, which we learned about each other and which has an informative impact on bigger events that were to follow. And without recording the experience of people who went through that, the feeling of that period would be lost. It would be not understood in the way that we experienced it. And it was that experience that I wanted to capture with the book and to use the interview format to base the book upon.
Yeah, I really loved the interview format because it captures all of these unique experiences, but blends them all together in this narrative that you don't get from maybe a traditional history that's looking at maybe more administrative sources or things like that. How was the process? How many interviews do you think you did? How long did it take you? I mean, this is not an easy task.
Right. Well, originally, I thought of this as a project that would be interviewing Americans, and then I had Russian co-authors who were going to do the same with Russians. How did they perceive this period? And it quickly became clear that that would be a huge undertaking and much too big for one book. So around, I think, 2017, I kind of formulated the idea of the book and put it as a book proposal to Routledge. And at the time, I thought, well, based on people I already knew, I thought I can easily get 25 or 30 interviews. And then I thought that would be really sufficient to give me the material for the book. Well, almost everyone I spoke to said, oh, no, you got to speak to so-and-so and so-and-so. And it just mushroomed. It exploded. So everyone wanted to talk about their experience. And I found that many of them had the same experience I had, was that people hadn't listened. And now they were in a circumstance where they had an opportunity to tell their story, and they grabbed a hold of that opportunity. Now, it's important also to know that the people I interviewed were people who liked Russia, by and large, who enjoyed their time there, who felt they grew from it and learned things from it. I'm not sure they're the majority of Americans who were active then. I mean, that people's kind of split in different parts. There were people who were expats who lived in Russia who hated it, couldn't stand the food, never learned the language, you know, got hardship pay, went to expat restaurants and hung out with other expats, and then went home and told everybody what an crazy experience it had been. The people I interviewed were people who built businesses, who integrated themselves into the society, who got a much deeper appreciation of Russian and Russian culture. And as such, they were eager to talk about this. And so they led me from one to another person. And this expanded. Now, what also happened was COVID. And I started my interviews not long before COVID hit. So nobody was going anywhere. And we all had time on our hands. And I used Zoom to do my networking and recording of the interviews. And it was, in some ways, a lucky coincidence that it happened during that period. But it took a long time for me to complete all these interviews. I mean, interviews would be anywhere from an hour to 3 hours. Some people I interviewed twice. It took a long time to arrange the interviews. So I would say the whole process took me about 4 years to complete. Yeah. And most of the interviews were also done prior to the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. So that's an important aspect of this, because they were focused on an earlier period. It just grew to over 100 interviews. I think 105 or 106. The problem with that number of interviews is I couldn't use everything. The Routledge, who was my publisher, had given me a page limit and a word limit. And so I had to squeeze as much as I could into those pages and select carefully pieces of interviews that were much larger and much more detailed than I could include. And in the original draft, which I thought was the final draft, I left out the section on telecommunications. And I wrote to the people who I had interviewed, and I said, thank you for your contributions, but I couldn't use everything. And I unfortunately had to leave some things out, including telecom. Well, I got a furious response from Stan Crampton, who was with US West at that period, and who had been one of the people that introduced the mobile technologies through US West into Russia. And he said, no, you cannot leave this out. You have to put something in about telecom, otherwise the picture isn't complete. And so I went back to the publisher. They gave me a few more pages. I cut some things out and we managed to squeeze it in. But there are many, many other things that I couldn't include. There's a lot about AmCham, about other expat organizations, business organizations. I just didn't have room to cover.
And could you describe your personal experience in Russia? Because the book's subtitle is Through the American Eyes, so that also includes your eyes as the author. What was your perception of Russia in the 90s and beyond?
Okay, my initial contact with Russia was in 1984. I'm an attorney by background and training, and I got a flyer from Intourist, which was the Soviet tour agency, offering a trip to the Soviet Union for lawyers as a learning experience. It was, I think, for under $1,500, airfare included. So it was a group trip. So I found a friend of mine who wanted to go. We went in 84. It was not what I expected, and it was really interesting. I went back with my wife in 1985 because she was jealous that she hadn't had a chance to see the place, at least. And so in 84, we went to Leningrad, Moscow, Kiev, and Minsk. And then in 1985, my wife and I went to Tbilisi. Well, we started with St. Petersburg, well, then Leningrad, Moscow, Tbilisi, Tashkent, and Irkutsk, and then back to Moscow and went home. I began to take Russia seriously in 89 when I got tired of being a lawyer and went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy to get a master's degree. And decided, and this at this point, Russia was beginning to open up. I had to learn Russian as part of my degree requirement. So I went again through Intouris to Russian language program. And then I got a job as I was just graduating from Fletcher with one of the early then Soviet American joint ventures. And we were importing rare earth oxides into the U.S. for making cubic zirconium from yttrium oxide. This was before anybody really had this obsession with rare earths and as battery material. And this just started off my involvement with Russia. Now, and during the 90s, I traveled there in conjunction with several joint ventures, but I never lived there. So at the height of the period that I was there, I traveled 5-6 times a year. So I was sent some years I spending like a third of my life there, a lot in the provinces, less in Moscow. So when I went to study Russian language, then later in Yaroslavl. And I remember the first thing that one of the people who met us at the airport said is, you have to understand that Russia is not Moscow. And so it's an important lesson. And it was one that sort of characterized a lot of my career in Russia, which was outside of Moscow. And not in provinces of in Yaroslavl and Perm and in the Far East and elsewhere. I'm not sure. Did I answer your question?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. And you know, I know that there's a common theme among a lot of these, you know, you call them expats, but Americans going to Russia, that they get hooked almost, that they become interested and then it kind of pulls them in. But to kind of get into something very interesting that I really had not even read about or heard about very much was this citizen diplomacy movement. Could you talk a little bit about that and the space bridges and the involvement of the Esalen Institute and the human potential movement? Because when those things came up, I was like, it was a little bit difficult for me to find the connections. I was like, oh my, wow, this is, these are some unlikely bedfellows.
Right. Well, look, if you put yourself back in this period, it was the height of the Cold War, there was a real threat of nuclear exchange. And the United States had just come out of the Vietnam War not long ago, and there were fairly strong peace organizations or independent organizations that were, I guess, what we would call civil society, that were non-governmental organizations of some strength that came out of that period. And people in America were concerned about how to prevent there being a nuclear exchange. So there was that kind of underlying motivation to try to understand, well, and there was the sort of assumption was, well, only if we understood each other better, we would be able to get along and diffuse this threat of a nuclear exchange. Now, when in my book, it really begins with the Esalen Institute, because what you have to understand about that period, and I think it may be important for understanding the future as well, is that the contacts between Americans and Russians were people who were considered marginal by the larger society, weirdos or not, you know, in the mainstream. So the original contact between Esalen and the Russian Academy of Sciences was because Esalen was looking at parapsychology, telepathy, auras, these things which are kind of new agey, you know, research. And they learned that the Soviets were also interested in the same. And the Soviets were considering this as research into human potential. They want to understand human potential. So they were holding a conference about this in Tbilisi in, I think, 1979. The Esalen Institute sent two people there, Jim Hickman and his girlfriend at the time, whose name escapes me right now. And Hickman came back and said, well, you know, look, we have to establish regular contact with these people. And so Esalen put together an institute for these exchanges with the Soviet Union. And Hickman became the executive director of it. And they began inviting people to go back and forth and conducting experiments, you know, with telepathy and so on. And then the next milestone in this was the US Festival, which Steve Wozniak organized. And it was, we'll have to double check this, but I think it was 1982. And it was a big rock and roll festival in a stadium with big screens. And they were planning it, and they kind of got in this kind of brainstorming, I don't know what you would call it, and said, wow, what if we hooked up the Soviet Union to this? And wouldn't that be cool? And they knew that Hickman was the gateway to that, because he had had already these exchanges and going back and forth. And he was in the middle of a project to form an association of American astronauts and Soviet cosmonauts. It was supposed to be an organization of people who had gone into space. And he was traveling with the American astronaut, Rusty Spiker, to go to Russia for that project. And so he then was charged with, well, look, see if you can set up some kind of space bridge. And, you know, in conjunction with many other people, not through just him alone, but they set up the first one. And the Soviet Gus Teleradio, the state television radio, set up a studio in Moscow, and they wanted to use this new technology of space communications to do a simultaneous broadcast between the US Festival and their studio in Moscow. So it was set up. The Russians had, you know, young Russians and Russian rock and roll bands in the studio. And in California, all of a sudden, here comes in the intermission between a couple of the bands, here comes a screen with Moscow. And Bill Graham, who's a famous music producer whose family was Hungarian, I believe, he saw this on the screen and he said, this is fake. This can't be true. They're in this Russian embassy in Washington. This is not from Moscow. And so he pulled the plug on the transmission. And the people in California called Hickman, who was in Moscow with the Russians, and said, we don't know what to do. Graham just pulled the plug. And Jim said, well, the Russians don't know, so let's just keep going with it. And so they then followed up the next year with another US Festival, and it was much more extensive. And the people who were involved with that technologically then went on to set up a whole series of space bridges that took place in the 1980s, sort of under the same notion that if we understood each other better, we wouldn't want to kill each other. And these exchanges sort of began and then grew. So they grew into a series of, at one point they were on ABC News and on Nightline and at night, and they had Peter Jennings, who was the most famous anchor of that time, was on the U.S. side. And then, the famous Russian TV anchor was on the other side. And they had members of the U.S. Congress and the Senate who were participating with members of the Supreme Soviet. And they were discussing things like the environment and the third world and, you know, possible conflict between the two countries. And millions of people were watching this in the Soviet Union. And, you know, it was on mainstream news. It's inconceivable that such a thing would happen in the United States now. But it was a phenomenon, and it was something that, as you said, when you introduced it, many people don't even know that it happened, but it was an important aspect of citizen diplomacy that took place outside of government-to-government contact in that period of time.
And why was that citizen diplomacy so kind of active? Because two societies were basically taught to hate each other for almost 70 years. And there was animosity towards communists in the U.S., towards Westerners in the USSR. But nevertheless, those bridges, TV bridges, like you were talking about, they existed. So what kind of spurred that and kept people going?
I think on the U.S. side, there was genuine fear of nuclear exchange. That there was a set of Americans who did not want a nuclear war. And so they had the Physicians for Social Responsibility. You had a number of organizations like that who were fostering and supporting this kind of a dialogue. On the Russian side, I think it was less about peace and more about curiosity about, you know, the America. And amongst some people, there was a beginning sense that they were behind and they wanted to get access to technology. So this space bridge was technology enabled, and there was a lot of technology exchange that went on around it. And so I'll give you another example of this process. There was an American who, Joel Schatz, who was interested in peace, and his wife was at a project to do a coloring book for, you know, peace. And he wrote to this Soviet embassy in the U.S. and said, can you get me a visa? He got a visa. He and his wife went. On the way to the airport, he buys a Radio Shack computer, one of those early Radio Shack computers, and takes it with him. Well, just so he meets with people in the Russian Academy of Sciences through contacts that Esalen established for him. And they were very interested in those computers because there were no personal computers in Russia at that time, in the Soviet Union, not Russia. And they were very interested in technology exchange. So Joel was interested in peace. They were interested in technology exchange. And the relationship for two different purposes grew in common and ended up with the first internet connections between the United States and the Soviet Union. And Sovan Teleport, which Joel founded, was the first email and internet connection between the two countries. Again, very different objectives on each side, but they found a common sort of activity that expressed both of those objectives.
Kind of speaking to maybe the disorganized or bottom-up way that a lot of this ended up being organized, you write about the Peace Corps and how the Peace Corps used volunteers, but how different these volunteers were from, so usually Peace Corps volunteers being, you know, in their 20s and kind of young, but these people who were going, and maybe this is in the already into kind of the post-Soviet era, but these volunteers, these business experts and things kind of being dropped into the country. What was this process like? What are these? It seems very strange to me that, you know, the USAID and the Peace Corps and things were allowing the like their people to go out without any sort of guidance.
Yeah. Well, the story, as I understand it, was James Baker, who was Bush's Secretary of State, went over to Russia soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union and promised aid to Yeltsin and promised technical aid as to how to build a market economy. So he comes back to Washington and discovers that there's no real means of doing that, that there's no experience with that. And the most experience that that you had was in the Peace Corps. And at least it had an administrative apparatus and a way of operation. And so he went to the Peace Corps and said, you know, we need help and we need to send Americans there as technical experts about how to build a market economy. And so they placed ads in newspapers for people who had business skills. So it wasn't just well-meaning volunteers who went to teach literacy or English language or how to dig a well. These were people that were sought for business skills. So the original group, there were 50 that were sent to the lower Volga region and 50 that were sent to the Far East. And they got a real rapid education in Russian, like maybe 6 weeks of Russian, and then they were sort of established and distributed to different factories and cities. And this was one something that was decided at the top between the Russian government of Yeltsin and the American government, but the regional governments had no idea what these people were doing, why they were there, and they, you know, had their own views of what they were doing. And one of the people who's one of the original Peace Corps guys told me that they were sort of the vanguard of capitalism, bringing capitalism, and they were supposed to have housing provided by the local hosts, and they received a stipend that was equivalent to the local wages. And for many of them, it was barely enough to live on, and they were kind of left on their own. There was an interesting story one of them told me about he was in Vladivostok in the Russian Far East, and he was living in a dormitory there, and he had a stipend, and all he could do was go to the local stores, which had nothing on the shelves, and buy things that he didn't know how to cook. And it was a very difficult existence for him. And he was really depressed about it because he didn't really know, what am I doing here? What am I supposed to be accomplishing? And he told a story about being in the hallway, sort of in the stairwell, moping and kind of looking downcast. And a Russian woman who was sort of part of the program came up to him and said, listen, you Americans will never stick it out. You're just too weak. You're too weak to, you know, cope with a Russian reality. And the irony is this guy still was there until the Ukrainian invasion of Ukraine. And the woman immigrated to the U.S. when she got the opportunity. So it was, you know, it's crazy times. But these the guys in the lower Volga told me they set up an office and they were supposed to be giving out business advice. Well, the Russians who came in said, we don't want advice. We want money. We thought you were going to give away money. So, and again, real mismatch. But there were some, you know, many of those people stayed who were in the Peace Corps, and they learned about Russian reality, and they actually did participate in building the market economy to a certain extent in the Russian provinces. I could go on. The problem is I could go on and on about all these stories, but it's a shorter answer.
Yeah, I'd like to touch maybe upon Yeltsin, because you have a really great quote in the book that essentially the goal of shock therapy was to prevent any possible restoration of the planned economy, which, you know, in 96, when there's the looming election where Yeltsin's support is in the single digits and the communists look like they're about to come back into power. What did your kind of interlocutors, what did your interviewees, what did they have to say about that time? Because I feel like, especially now, that period, 96, 97, 98, which is just total chaos. There's no other way to put it in Russia. And what did they have to say about that time and their role in shock therapy and things like that?
Well, okay. So if you want to talk about shock therapy, you're really talking about the early 90s. By the election of 1996, there was already a set of Russian oligarchs who controlled major enterprises and banks in Russia. And the Americans were excluded from the privatization, the loans for shares program in 1996. Only these oligarchs could take place, with the exception of George Soros and Harvard University, who were allowed to take part because of their, what should we say, service to the country in the early 90s. But the early 90s is where Americans had the biggest impact, and in which we talked a lot, because the Russian reformers around Yeltsin knew that they had a limited amount of time before their opponents sort of recovered their bearings. And what they wanted to do was take away the basis of the socialist planned economy by privatizing as much as they could, as fast as they could, as Chubais, Anatoly Chubais, who was head of the privatization fund, said they were kamikazes. They thought that they had a limited time, and so they wanted to privatize as fast as possible. So they did not really know how to do it. So they relied on Western advisors to help them carry out that intention. So they already had some existing ties with Harvard. They brought in Jeffrey Sachs and the Harvard HIID. Harvard Institute of International Development, to help them conceptually put this together, this coupons program in the early 90s. And then they also looked for international financial institutions to help them. So they held a tender, and Boris Jordan, who's a third generation American, whose grandparents fought on the white Russian side in the Civil War, so it had gone to Credit Suisse and said, look, we have this opportunity in Russia, let's jump into it. And he convinced them, or at least his managing director, to put their tender bid in to the Russian government that they would do the technical part of this privatization for nothing. They wouldn't charge them. And so obviously they won the bid. And so you know, Jordan and his colleagues sort of holed up in the, I believe it was the National Hotel, it might have been the Metropole, but, and took what the Harvard people had started and recast it into the coupon-based privatization, in which every Russian citizen got a coupon worth, I think it was 10,000 rubles. And they were able, they were theoretically able to bid on shares, enterprises who were listed for privatization. And so what the Russian government did is it privatized, using this coupon and shock therapy, 15,000 enterprises. But these were mostly the smaller and insignificant ones. They held back the crown jewels of the energy sector and natural resource sector, and they did not privatize those at that time. They waited, and those then got privatized in 1996 in the period you were describing, and only to Russians who were going in. So they started with this massive privatization, and also significantly, they privatized apartments. Because before, in the Soviet times, you had a right to live. You had a propusk, which gave you the right to live in an apartment, but you didn't own it. It could be passed down to your kids, but still, you didn't own it. You couldn't sell it. You couldn't do it, treat it as your private property. What Yeltsin did very early on, and it built a lot of support for privatization, was to say you could privatize your apartment by just going to an office, filing the paperwork, and you became the owner of your own apartment. And this was a big plus for many people who went through that process. But, you know, shock therapy, the initial privatization was a shock to society, and it was imposed from the top down. Most Russians had no idea what these coupons, what they were supposed to do with these coupons. And so they sold them on the street to brokers who gathered up as many as they could and then used them to buy into the privatized industries. At the same time, the former Soviet economy was just in total collapse, and people were really much worse off than they had been before it. So, you know, so Americans played an important role as technical advisors and implementers of this. And Harvard got themselves in a mess with it because several of their staff were accused of insider trading. And the federal government sued Harvard for this insider trading and misuse of grant funds. And they ended up with Harvard settling for one of the largest, at that time, it had been the largest settlement paid by a U.S. educational institution to the government for this kind of an offense. And the Harvard Institute of International Development was disbanded as a result of this. So, and that's all described in the book.
And do you think that the privatization was necessary, that shock therapy was necessary? Was it well-meaning by the Americans and by the Russians? Because, as you know, there's a lot of speculation right now that the politicians, as you said, didn't know what they were doing, but also that they had some malign intent to basically privatize it to the rich oligarchs and basically make Russia into an oligarchy. And what would your advice be now, with the benefit of hindsight, on how to conduct those activities properly and how they should have been conducted?
Okay, let's start in the beginning. So I think they did know what they were doing. They were preventing socialism from coming back. If private property, if the enterprises and the apartments were in a hall, hands of private parties, those private parties would defend that private property against an attempt to re-socialize it. And to this day, That has not happened. You can say what you, you know, the Russian economy is dominated by the state, but it's not, it has not renationalized private property. So there's nuances to that, but basically that transformation took place. It was huge. And it is really the topic of most of the book. It's how that impacted the lives of people and new sectors of the economy developed as a result of this privatization. So that's why I talk about real estate and finance and service industry and media that didn't exist in Soviet times that came to exist post-Soviet because of privatization. It made a huge impact on people's lives. So you asked me a multi-part question. So I'm go back to what some of it I missed. So refresh my memory on that.
Yes, of course. What would your advice be now, or how should the privatization and shock therapy have been conducted properly with the benefit of hindsight?
Wow. You know, I don't have a good answer for that because that's just real speculation. I think that the people involved in it believed in markets, and it was the predominant thinking of the time worldwide that markets are superior form of economic organization, and they will ultimately sort themselves out and solve problems. So the view was at the time, it doesn't matter who becomes the owner. It's just that it's owned by someone, and that over time, those owners would come to see the value of improving this property, of responding to the market, whether it's domestic or international. They would have competition. They would become more efficient. They would operate better. And the overall welfare of the society would be improved. This is sort of the neoliberal consensus of that time, which less government, more markets, was the same in the US as it was there. They bought that as an organizing principle for their society and this neoliberal view. So there are people who were involved with that privatization who said it worked. It worked. And so, you know, how could it have been done differently? You know, counterfactuals are really difficult because it's very, what I tried to do with the book is really talk about what people thought at the time. I don't really like the approach of, say, looking back from now, how do we judge the actions of people in that time period? It's not fair, and I'm not sure it really tells us very much, you know. So I'm going to skip that, the answering how it should have been done better. I don't know the answer to that. I think, though, it's that we don't have a good handle on how it was really done and why, what the motivations were. Clearly, the people who emerged as owners were the people who, most of whom had come out of the nomenklatura. They had come out of the privileged sectors of the society that had been privileged under Soviet times, that had education, that had some idea what it meant to be in business or what markets, or could gather that knowledge quickly. And most of that first round of oligarchs came from that strata of society, which I guess you could say, well, that's predictable because, you know, they knew how to manipulate that system. But again, for the people who were running it and the Russian reformers, that didn't matter. It just mattered that there was a market and that was a market, institutions were established.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, that's a history I think that everyone who studies modern Russia should revisit, because I think that a lot of the structures that exist now were laid in those years but have kind of been forgotten. And maybe just to wrap all this up, I mean, there's so many different episodes. Anybody who's interested in any part of the late 80s and 90s and all of this should go and get the book as soon as possible. But what can we learn now in maybe a new, there's talk of a new Cold War. What can we learn about all of this kind of partnership and engagement and kind of cross-cultural coordination? What lessons can we take away, especially maybe younger people who hope one day to do such citizen diplomacy, things like that?
Right, right. So first of all, I think from citizen diplomacy point of view, I think whatever contacts emerge between Americans and Russians outside of government is hard to predict, but it won't be, it will be small efforts on the margins by people who are trying to build those contacts again. History will not repeat itself in the sense that not only are Russians in Russia now familiar with how a market economy works and have the skills to do it and don't need foreigners for that purpose, but there's a huge diaspora of Russians outside the country who also know those skills and know them quite well. And so they, you know, depending upon how the politics of the country evolves, it's a quite different situation than it was after the fall of the Soviet Union. But one thing that a number of people have remarked to me as important is a notion, respect, that there was a feeling, and I express this in the book among some Americans, is that Russia lost the Cold War. They had to be taught like pupils to live like we do and to behave properly like we do. And that didn't go over well. The society that has 1,000 years of, you know, its own cultural development and achievements. And so once Russians started to gain the skills that they lacked to run their own economy and to participate in the international economy, they began saying, and to be brief, stop telling me how to live. And whatever we may think of how they live or what their political views are, we're not going to make any progress without having a collaborative or respectful approach. And it is hard to sort of get our arms around that because we do have so fiercely defend our own values and think of them as universal, but they're not, it's not going to work in the context of reestablishing maybe collaboration on important overall things, things like climate change or things that can't be solved without collaboration. If and when the war in Ukraine is resolved and you begin to have an interchange between the two countries, it can't be based on lectures about how they are supposed to live. And there has to be a different sort of basis of attitude and respect in the relationship. I don't want to talk about what the specifics of that one might be because it all depends on a lot of things. But I think that's a constant and something that many people that I interviewed spoke about.
Well, Mr. Sitinsky, I want to thank you for coming on the Slavic Connection. We really loved your book, so I'm going to recommend it to anyone who wants to learn more about the late 80s and 1990s and and maybe try and take some of those lessons away about what is possible, even when two countries are seemingly ideologically completely different.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thanks so much for, you know, talking to me about the book, and I could go on and on, but I won't. And I hope that your listeners will read the book, and I'm happy to entertain any questions that they may have. Thank you.
Slavic Connection is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin. The opinions expressed in this program represent the views of the hosts and the guests, and not of the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit us online at slavxradio.com. Thank you.
The Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies condemns the Russian Federation's military invasion of Ukraine. We stand in support of the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their lives and sovereignty in the face of the unjustified invasion by Russian military forces.
Subject, you know, to especially students, like you said, because it is very accessible. It's not one of those very scientific Routledge books that you read and you just want to tear your eyes out, you know. So that's not, I was going in with an idea of like it's gonna be bad, you know, like, but like it turned out to be amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing.